Transitioning to a decarbonised economy sounds like just one change. In fact, this shift requires several transitions across sectors, geographies, and timelines. In Talking Transitions, a new podcast brought to you by the EY organisation and Foresight Climate and Energy, we look at how the transition is affecting three key areas: energy, financial services, and government. The Talking Transitions podcast is out now. Download today from wherever you get your podcasts or visit talkingtransitions.com to find out more.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
From The Times and The Sunday Times, this is The Story. I'm Manveen Rana.
They were targeted systematically, car by car.
For the famous, award-winning celebrity chef, Jose Andreas, it wasn't the sort of statement he would ever have expected to make.
So this was not just a bad luck situation where, oops, we dropped the bomb in the wrong place. We were targeted deliberately, nonstop, until everybody was dead in this convoy.
But when seven aid workers from his charity, World Central Kitchen, were killed by the Israeli Defense Forces in Gaza, he demanded answers.
I need to understand that this was not by somebody that is above law and order.
His anger has been echoed by the Western governments who had been supporting Israel.
Australia expects full accountability for the deaths of aid workers, which is completely unacceptable.
Whatever the reason was that led to this tragedy, whatever the mistake that happened inside the IDF, it's unacceptable.
We're asking Israel to investigate what happened urgently because clearly there are questions that need to be answered.
It's not a war against terrorism anymore. Seems this is a war against humanity itself.
Now, there's a growing clamour in the UK to stop providing Israel with weapons. A former national security advisor, 600 lawyers, including three former Supreme Court judges, and, increasingly, politicians from across the spectrum say it's time to stop arming Israel.
I've called for a suspension of arms sales. I mean, I think it's impossible now for any of the Foreign Office lawyers to justify continuing sales to Israel.
By ending British arms exports to Israel, it would send a very, very powerful signal, not just to Israel, but to America, who supplies most of arms to Israel.
The story today: how Israel lost its allies.
I'm Gabrielle Weiniger. I'm reporting for The Times on the Israel-Gaza war, and I've been reporting from the region for over a decade.
And Catherine.
I'm Catherine Philp. I'm the World Affairs Editor for The Times. I was reporting in Israel following the October 7th attacks last year. But I've also been based in Jerusalem and in the region, covering a lot of the relationships between different Middle Eastern countries.
Catherine, earlier this week, seven aid workers working for the World Central Kitchen were killed doing their job. This is a charity that you know well. Just tell us a bit about what they do and how you first came across them.
So I first came into contact with World Central Kitchen in Kyiv, in Ukraine, just after the Russians had invaded, purely by the fact that the team led by Jose Andreas himself, the celebrity chef who founded the organization, had led the team out there. He goes where his people go. And so they were all staying in our hotel. And so we used to see them most evenings, exchange information about different places. They'd tell us somewhere they'd been. And we were all struck by how incredibly intrepid they were. They were in some of the worst places in Ukraine as soon as, or even faster than we as journalists were. So they were straight into Bucha the same day that we were there with bodies lying in the streets. It obviously is an enormous operation, but it does draw a great deal of its sort of mission and sense of charisma from José Andrés himself, who is possibly the most famous and the best chef in the whole of Washington, D.C. He has several very upmarket restaurants there, and this is part of his giving back project, his sort of passion project.
The team of World Central Kitchen were able to deliver 8 trucks to the north, over 200 tons, around 500,000 meals. We must do more. We need to do everyday shipments to the north. We can solve the hunger problem in the north.
But of course, by living where he does and having those hotels and restaurants, he's also incredibly highly politically connected. And he's someone who's proven ability to get through difficult situations with a lot of imagination. And that's really how they ended up to be the first people to land food and water, fresh water, into Gaza before anyone else had managed to. And that, again, partly was because they developed very good relationships with the IDF, which not all other NGOs have. There's obviously quite an enormous tension between a lot of the NGOs and the Israeli government, but not World Central Kitchen. I mean, they actually first arrived in October hoping to feed displaced Israelis who'd been displaced from the kibbutz that had been attacked, and, you know, spoke about that mission very powerfully.
And just give us a sense of what the charity does.
Yeah, I mean, effectively, they bring food to communities who do not have them. But the twist is they do all the cooking and they set up these mass kitchens. So it's not just like a food distribution with WFP where you see someone get given a sack of rice and off they go. It's very appropriate in this situation where all people's household items have been abandoned or destroyed that they would set up these kitchens. Their volunteers would begin doing all the cooking. And as time goes on, they would spread out these kitchens to different parts of a conflict zone. And the people there would take over more and more responsibility for that on a kind of template that they had shown them.
Gabrielle, you're in Tel Aviv. We understand that this chef, José Andrés, had this great relationship with the Israeli Defense Forces. Talk us through what actually happened, as far as we know, on Monday.
The World Central Kitchen brought in their second shipment of food onto a floating pier that they'd built specially somewhere in central Gaza, near where this incident happened, actually. Pretty quickly, you would imagine, they unloaded and brought it to a warehouse. Once it was at the warehouse, 3 cars, all clearly marked with the World Central Kitchen logo on the top and on the sides, left the warehouse there and travelled along the coastal road. In separate cars, 3 cars, they were quite far away from each other when the incident happened, so about a mile and a half away down the road. The first strike hit the first car. The survivors of that first strike ran out the car and went to safety to the second car. Once they got into the second car, they managed to make a call to tell people on the ground or who was handling their operations what was happening when a second missile was dropped. Sources are telling us that it was a drone strike. That dropped through the roof of the car. Again, the remaining passengers who survived that strike took out the injured and went to the third car. And the third car was struck as well, and it hit and killed everybody in that convoy. So that was 7 people in total.
And you mentioned that, you know, these vehicles were clearly marked. The way that the World Central Kitchen works on the ground, I mean, would the IDF have known where they are?
My understanding is that they did, and that anyone travelling on Al Rashid Road must get that permission.
Yeah, I think that's right, actually. They did have coordination, but then Israel's also saying it was because of a lack of coordination that this was caused. So it's quite strange that, yes, they had this coordination with aid groups, but then the killing resulted from poor coordination. So something went wrong between the war room, which is called the IDF Southern Command, and the communication with the aid groups.
I want to be very clear. The strike was not carried out with the intention of harming WCK aid workers. It was a mistake that followed a misidentification at night during a war in a very complex conditions. It shouldn't have happened.
We've read reports in Israeli media saying that actually the incident was nothing to do with coordination, and it wasn't the mistake that Israeli military officials are touting it as, and saying actually it's all down to the fact that there's poor discipline among the field commanders in this IDF Southern Command, and every commander sets rules for himself. Usually they would get permission or authorization to open fire by senior commanders. It's not clear if that happened this time. It could well be that somebody on the ground thought they identified an armed person and took their own initiative and just struck the convoy.
An independent body will investigate the incident thoroughly. We will complete it in the next coming days. We will learn from the conclusions and implement them immediately.
And this does happen. This isn't the first time we're seeing aid workers killed. The UN said 196 aid workers have been killed since the war started in October. So sometimes they act without repercussions. This has turned into an international incident because, of course, this is the first time that foreign nationals were killed.
And Catherine, I mean, that is the irony. These aren't the first aid workers to have been killed, but they are the first to have got an international reaction. Just talk us through what the reaction has been.
Look, we shouldn't be surprised by this. The levels of carnage and the images of carnage coming out of Gaza are quite overwhelming. I think it almost takes something different for people to pay attention anymore, which is a great shame. And obviously, people are going to be shocked when they find out three nationals, just of one country, Britain, in that convoy. And that has immediately focused attention back onto what happened. There's this very austere graphic image that I think is being used everywhere of the gloved hands of the surgeon at the hospital holding up these passports covered in blood, one of the new British blue-black ones. You have to make a fuss when these things happen. The ambassador was called in to the Foreign Office for a dressing down. Some people said, oh, this is extraordinary. It hasn't happened in 12 years. And some of the language we've seen coming out of the Foreign Office and coming out of officials, things like unforgivable, unacceptable, those are not words you immediately jump to if you genuinely think this is an accident. And I think it's going to be very, very difficult for the Israelis to prove this was an accident.
And Gabby, how is this being reported in Tel Aviv?
It was moved on from, I would say, quite quickly. They don't seem to understand, or at least the news doesn't seem to want to portray what's happening in Gaza to the Israeli public. It's not something they spend time on. Much more important to the Israeli public is the situation of the hostages. Hearing there are 134 Israeli hostages still held in Gaza, hearing about the death of soldiers, analysing military strategy, interviewing people who were present on October the 7th, which is still very much a very fresh trauma for Israelis. So I spoke to some Israelis today who didn't even know what happened yesterday. A lot of people don't really want to tune into the news. Yeah, it's surprising. The Israelis that do know what happened, I think they would buy the idea that it was an accident, that these things happen in the fog of war, that the IDF system is functioning and that they are the most moral army in the world. These are the things we hear out of Israel quite a lot. And rather, the overall blame for everything that happens in Gaza, I think, is always left on Hamas's doorstep when it comes to the Israeli perception of what's happening there.
That's so interesting. And this comes at a time when You know, the UN has already last week said that famine, starvation, is being used as a weapon of war in Gaza.
The extent of Israel's continued restrictions on the entry of aid into Gaza, together with the manner in which it continues to conduct hostilities, may amount to the use of starvation as a method of war, which is a war crime.
How much is that reported on? And just give us a sense of how bad the situation is on the ground, as far as we know, and how the UN's comments on that were met in Israel.
Well, we have to remember that Israel's blockaded the Gaza Strip ever since Hamas took over in 2007. So that's 16 years of essentially closure and besieged territory. There's no airport in Gaza. There was clearly no port. So the idea of things getting in and out of Gaza and being Israel's responsibility, it's just background noise to them. They think that any aid that's going in, this is very general, but they think any aid going in is gets stolen by Hamas and we're feeding Hamas terrorists. And look, however bad it was before, it's far, far worse now. The UN saying that Gaza is on the brink of famine. There are reports that famine's already set in, and actually the UN-backed group that announces and does these analysis on the situation of food insecurity, I've heard from sources that they're going to declare that famine has set in, certainly in the coming weeks. So just to paint a picture of what that looks like on the ground, and unfortunately, international journalists, Catherine especially and myself, people who would go in usually to the ground in Gaza and report from there, haven't been allowed in since October. So any information coming out is from aid groups and from local journalists on the ground. And these UN analyses are saying that 300,000 people in the north of Gaza are facing acute malnutrition. So they're eating or cooking animal fodder to make it into flour. They're foraging for wild plants. They're drinking unclean water. There have been several reports of children dying of malnutrition and severe, severe hunger, a lack of basic food, supplies and medicine. So the reason this is happening in the north and not in the south, and we'll get to the South Gaza in a second, but the north has been cut off as a deliberate Israeli military strategy. It's been cut off by a new road that's been built dividing the north and the south in order for Israel to control those areas in a more strategic way for the Israeli battle plans. So in South Gaza, I think aid gets in a little bit easier because it's coming in from Rafah. But that being said, there's still a scarcity of portable water. There's rising prices of basic goods. There's a lack of food, empty shops, and we've seen long, long lines of people queuing for food. People basically just constantly on the search for food. So that's certainly a situation of food insecurity. So in the north, while you're facing starvation, in the south, you don't know where your next meal is coming from.
And now, with a famine underway, it does look like as a result of these killings, there will be less aid coming in altogether.
I think that's the sad truth, isn't it? I mean, with aid organisations pulling out left, right and centre now after what's happened to the World Central Kitchen and the two ships that arrived to bring in aid from Cyprus, they've been sent back. There was another ship that was loaded with, I think, 240 tons of food, and that's headed back already to Cyprus without making any deliveries. I think one third of the total aid got delivered and two thirds is being sent back. And just to give you a bit of context, the World Central Kitchen provides 60% of all the aid that's not coming from governments such as the UAE and Jordan. So that's a huge, yeah, it's a huge number. So it's going to contribute to an even bigger crisis.
Coming up, is Israel losing the support of its allies? And what really happened at the Al-Shifa hospital? That's in just a moment. Our journalists do some incredible work around the world, and if you want to find out more about how it happens, we have something extra for all of our subscribers. Each weekend, we speak to one of our journalists for a bonus episode called Inside the Newsroom. It's available on Apple Podcasts to all Times subscribers. To find out how to access it, log on to thetimes.co.uk/bonuspodcasts.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Transitioning to a decarbonized economy sounds like just one change. In fact, this shift requires several transitions across sectors, geographies, and timelines. In Talking Transitions, a new podcast brought to you by the EY organization and Foresight Climate and Energy, we look at how the transition is affecting three key areas: energy, financial services, and government. The Talking Transitions podcast is out now. Download today from wherever you get your podcasts or visit talkingtransitions.com to find out more.
Gabby, one of the other major moments this week has been the withdrawal of the IDF from the Al-Shifa hospital. Just remind us of what's been happening there. What was the aim of the operation? How long has it taken?
So Al-Shifa is one of the largest hospital complexes in Gaza. It's in central Gaza, and it's one of the most advanced institutions in the entire strip. So it's a huge part of providing medical care and desperately needed medical care to Gaza.
This was Al-Shifa Hospital around a week ago. Israeli tanks in the courtyard. These are the ruins they left behind. Israeli forces today pulling out after a massive and deadly raid.
The army say their main aim was to expel Hamas militants and the Palestinian Islamic Jihad organization, which is a local militia group, from the hospital. They say they'd re-entered and reconquered or recaptured the hospital since they were expelled in December. So an IDF raid back in November, they say, was successful and got rid of Hamas. They seem to have gone back in. So that is why Israel launched a new raid that lasted 2 weeks, which is a really, really long time for a hospital to try and function. And when you look now at footage and you hear stories of people inside, it stands in ruins. There's been widespread damage to the entire complex. So we're talking all the different units, the maternity unit, the burns unit, the accident and emergency unit. After this 2 week raid, its charred remains, essentially. It has quite an iconic entrance. It's quite a wide facade with three big arches. It's all just burnt out and blackened. And what you'd normally see is a busy car park with people and ambulances. It's all just dust and bodies buried underneath the rubble. Israel, again, blames Hamas for the destruction of the hospital. They're saying that they fortified themselves inside the wards, and that's why Israel had to embark on this raid. And it was actually a surprise raid. They entered in the dead of night, and they surrounded the hospital with bulldozers and tanks, I think around 2 a.m, which is quite different to what happened in November and the first time they tried to kick out Hamas from being there, where they gave the hospital advance warning and told them a week in advance, we're coming in a week, so, you know, move your patients or whatever. This time it was just, sounds like absolute chaos and a very gruesome scene of death and destruction in the aftermath as well, with hospital equipment, beds, ambulances, just everything all destroyed.
Yeah, we should say this is one of the biggest hospitals in Gaza at a time where so many people are seriously injured, and it's now completely unworkable.
out of the 36 hospitals that function, that used to function in the Gaza Strip, there are now only 10 of them partially operational. Israel claims this operation was a huge success. They say the 200 Palestinians that were killed were all militants. They say their soldiers arrested around 900 people suspected of being militants, including senior commanders. Two Israeli soldiers were also killed in the raid. They say they evacuated the patients who were still left in the hospital, and they did everything they could to protect civilian casualties. They actually denied that there were civilian casualties at all, but that's not what we're hearing from inside the hospital. The WHO also said that 21 patients died since the Israeli raid began. We don't know how they died because it was just a complete blockade of communications. Also, as it was going on, it was very hard to know what was happening day by day because sources inside the hospital just didn't have any way of contacting the outside world. And we were quite reliant on what the Israeli army had and their press releases. And sometimes the army chief even stood outside the hospital and gave a televised statement about what was going on there.
Over the past week, our forces operated there outstandingly. Shifa has become a central terrorist headquarters for Hamas. Our forces' surprise action was carried out with precision. They killed more than 200 terrorists, among them senior commanders.
But civilians who were there say that they didn't see Hamas. Hamas wasn't using hospitals as a base, and that Israel just executed all the Palestinians inside.
I was in Shifa Hospital. We had staff also going to this hospital. We have never seen any sign of suspicious activities. If we were to hear about any sign of combatants within the hospital, the first reaction from Dr. Without Borders would be to pull out the team.
So it's just a complete contrast in narrative about what happened there. I think by the end of the raid, there were only 100 patients left. And they were left without any drinking water, with only minimal medication. So you can only imagine the chaos over those 2 weeks that people were going through there.
And Catherine, after the incidents recently with both the UN calling out the famine in Gaza as a weapon of war, the evidence from Al-Shifa, we also had a moment at the UN last week which people were genuinely shocked by. Talk us through what happened.
The result of the voting is as follows. 14 votes in favor, 0 vote against, 1 abstention. The draft resolution has been adopted as resolution 27.
Yes, the US was abstaining from a resolution that called on Israel to immediately halt all hostilities. Now, the US abstained, which was unusual enough. At the same time, Britain and France actually voted for it, which is somewhat bolder than Britain's been for some time. So I think that shows the depth of anger there is in London over what's going on. What's significant about the US abstaining is that it's one of the 5 powers that holds a veto over any resolution. And those veto powers are the US, Britain, France, Russia, and China. And it's often said that the council is more or less paralyzed at the moment because one or all of Russia, China, and the US will always veto one vote or another. So I think that this American veto was a real shot across the bows to Benjamin Netanyahu. He ought not to take US support in the Security Council for granted. And he doesn't just sort of have free rein to do whatever he wants, knowing that there's some huge, you know, schoolyard bully standing behind him who can sort out any mess that he leaves behind when he scampers off. It's a pretty dramatic evidence of, you know, a relationship that is not going well at all.
You talked about the anger coming out of the UK, particularly after this recent incident with the aid workers being killed. We've also heard calls, particularly from Peter Ricketts, a former national security advisor in the UK, saying it's time to stop arming Israel. Do you think that's something that is likely to happen, though, in both America and the UK?
I mean, I would have always said it was very unlikely, but I've never heard more and more various voices speak up in favour of of stopping those sales. There's rumoured to be all sorts of secret papers in Whitehall laying out how fragile the legal case is for continuing to arm a country that is using those weapons against, I would say, its own people, but certainly a people under its occupation. Those are very, very serious matters. And the problem with weapons of those kinds, if that is the bar you have to cross, then it's not just a question of you giving weapons, as the US has done in the past, enormous quantities of weapons to Israel. It's also about buying those weapons, so that if those human rights violations are proved to be correct, you may not even, under the international law, sell that country weapons. And obviously Israel is a big buyer of our military hardware.
You've talked through America and Britain. Are Israel's other allies, is there a sense that they're losing patience?
Yeah, I think there's a sense of across the West that people are losing patience. Obviously, the US Security Council, those are the ones to really look to, because they will have the most direct pressure and the most ability to influence. But I mean, I think the same is very true of many European countries whose capitals, you know, play the backdrop every weekend to these protests calling for an end to the war.
Gabby, you said earlier that ordinary Israelis don't seem to be aware of the anger that's building in the international community. Do you see that changing at all? What would it take for that to become an issue in the news in Israel?
I don't think it's that they're not aware of the anger in the international community. They just assume that the international community doesn't like Israel. It's not that they aren't aware of it. It's just that they're very inwardly focused right now. I mean, for example, Catherine mentioned the marches in London. That is covered in the Israeli media, and we see that on Saturdays on the news.
How is that talked about?
I think people are quite upset. I think they feel isolated. When the UN vote that you mentioned earlier happened, there was a lot of surprise that the US has betrayed them and hasn't supported them in the UN like they always have. And the US said, oh, this isn't a departure from our normal stance, but it certainly was. It certainly was. I think the Israelis feel that the 7th of October and the massacres that went on in the south of Israel have been forgotten. They feel like they did nothing to provoke the massacre. They feel like this war was brought upon them and it wasn't something they chose. And they're living the consequences of this in their daily life, just like the people of Gaza are living the consequences of this in their daily life. And the average person, I think, on both sides, it's just a lot of suffering right now. So there's this disparity between what's happening on the ground and how the international community view them. And I think Israelis feel very attacked and feel that their very survival is in jeopardy at this moment.
This weekend marks 6 months on from October the 7th and the start of the war. How do they view how the war has played out and how Netanyahu has handled it?
When the 7th happened in October and Israel went into Gaza first by air and later on the 26th of October by ground, Israel realised that this was going to be a long war, especially when things on the 9th of October kicked off from the north as well and people, you know, began to be evacuated from their homes. They knew it was going to be a long war. However, there are voices, and not just from the left wing and the more centrist parties or people in Israel, that feel that Netanyahu is prolonging the war for his own benefit in order to stay in power. And we're seeing a gradual gaining of momentum from within the Israeli public for calls for Netanyahu, for the prime minister, to step down. And in fact, just this week, families of hostages still held in Gaza, some families, not all of them, but they joined that call and they said, okay, Netanyahu's not getting the job done. We've given him 6 months to bring back our loved ones, and they're still there and they're going through hell in Gaza, and we want them back under any cost. And that cost might be bringing the country to elections, which, when Netanyahu addressed this himself this week, he said this will bring the country to a standstill for up to 8 months. I don't think it's a criticism of the war, rather of his leadership and his failure to get the hostages back. That's the central issue and the central part of criticism against Netanyahu at this time.
And finally, Catherine, you know, we've talked about some of the anger that's being expressed by Israel's allies at the moment in the West. There's also a lot of anger in terms of the protests taking place in the West and sort of younger generations who are seeing a lot of the footage coming out of Gaza on TikTok and are much more engaged in what's happening than they might have been in the past. Is there a danger for Israel that they're not only angering their allies now, but actually they may not be able to guarantee those relationships in the future if they don't win those younger generations back?
I think that's been the truth for some time. I may be the last generation, perhaps, who I didn't do this, but the last generation who, where people often took gap years and worked on kibbutzim in Israel. You know, I think that the Western impressions of Israel over the generations as they've gone on and as the occupation has deepened, I think it's just an issue that the younger generation is much more aware of than, you know, Israel's romanticized past that perhaps our parents would look at, the plucky little startup nation that, you know, that formed itself through the grit of the survivors of the Holocaust. I think that those born more recently see a different Israel, and it's a different Israel to the one that Israel sees itself when it looks in the mirror. And as I think Gabby was suggesting there is a very dangerous disconnect between the way that most of at least the younger generations in the world feel towards Israel versus Israel's own self-image.
That's Catherine Philp, World Affairs Editor at The Times, and Gabrielle Weiniger, our journalist on the ground covering the Israel-Gaza war from Tel Aviv. You can read the latest from both of them at thetimes.co.uk with a subscription. The producers today were Edward Drummond and Priyanka Dilardia. The executive producer is Kate Ford, and sound design was by Mao Lasseto. If you're interested in what's happening in Israel and Gaza, do listen back to some of our recent episodes, including one where I reported from Jerusalem and spoke to Ehud Olmert, the former Prime Minister of Israel, about his views on the ongoing war, and another where we tracked the progress of our correspondent on the ground in Gaza, Amal Hellas.
Before the war, we had everything, the finest food, the best clothes. We owned the houses with the beautiful views. We had everything. Everything was taken away from us. So if I have the chance to go out Gaza, I will do it.
We'll put the links to both of those in the description of this podcast. Thanks for listening. See you tomorrow.
Transitioning to a decarbonized economy sounds like just one change. In fact, this shift requires several transitions across sectors, geographies, and timelines. In Talking Transitions, a new podcast brought to you by the EY organization and Foresight Climate and Energy, we look at how the transition is affecting three key areas: energy, financial services, and government. The Talking Transitions podcast is out now. Download today from wherever you get your podcasts, or visit talkingtransitions.com to find out more.